Okay, it's part three of the Father Guido Sarducci School of Geopolitics. I say a resource, you say divide and rule, we say holistic. Planning on skipping the music intros and outros for this series just because just want to get right to the meat of it. And let's see, we're up to chapter five. This reader is about halfway through the book, up to the up to Pakistan and Britain and all kinds of interesting stuff. But this is chapter 5, The Global Islamic Mission. Throughout the 1960s, confrontation in the Middle East continued between the secular nationalist regimes led by Nasser's Egypt and the Islamic monarchies led by Saudi Arabia. As both sides jostled for influence throughout the region, the conflict found overt expression in a bloody, long-drawn-out war in Yemen, which lasted most of the decade. Typical of its strategy, Britain covertly joined forces with the Saudis to support the forces of the deposed Yemeni imam against a new republic regime backed by Nasser, promoting a civil war in which up to 200,000 people died. The British and Saudis feared that the Yemeni example of secular nationalism would have a domino effect spreading throughout the Middle East, perhaps even to Saudi Arabia itself, wrestling vital oil resources away from British and American control and placing them in the hands of popular governments, and more generally undermining Western influence in the region. Again and again, that's the book's message in a nutshell. The stakes were high since British companies owned 40% of the oil in the Gulf, with large shares in consortia in Kuwait and Iran especially. Two of the eight companies that controlled the oil trade were British, BP and Shell, meaning that Whitehall's interests lay not only in securing access to oil, but ensuring that British companies retained their commercial stake in the industry. The government accrued invisible earnings from British oil companies' production and sales in other countries, amounting to whatever the amount of British dollars that is, £800 million maybe, in the 5 years from 1961 to 65. By 1967, these companies had overseas worth of $2 billion. To protect these earnings, the British government had an explicit policy to oppose governments who expropriate or acquire too direct a control over Western oil investments, end quote, while their broad aim was described as, quote, to inhibit undue governmental interference in the oil trade, end quote. You gotta love hate that twisted verbiage there, to inhibit undue governmental interference. Well, you don't gotta, but that's my response. Let's see. Thus, the British and Saudis were also fearful of nationalist groups elsewhere in the Arabian Peninsula, especially as a country I didn't know of, Aden, A-D-E-N, and Oman. In 1964, Britain responded to a nationalist insurgency in Radfan province of western Aden by brutally bombing rebel villages and bribing local tribal leaders. The following year, Whitehall leaped to the defense of the Sultan of Oman, who presided over probably the most repressive regime in the post-war Middle East, where wearing glasses or talking to anyone for more than 15 minutes was banned, and where oil resources were concentrated in British and the Sultan's hands while the country remained completely undeveloped. Britain began what became a 10-year war to crush the Egyptian-backed rebels who proclaimed the liberation of Dhofar province in southern Oman. The Saudis first backed the Dhofari revolt to undermine the Omani Sultan, with whom they had an ongoing border dispute, but soon reverted to type in backing the regime. Yeah, this stuff is even more intense when reading it aloud, because when reading it on the page, it's kind of, you know, I kind of feel like I'm reading a spy novel. True spy novel, but reading it out loud really brings out the insanity and the manipulation of how stuff works. Now, another thing I learned from here was how, as the Saudi Arabia started to make the big bucks from the oil, they had to put that big buck somewhere, and so that became the British banking system. So you have this connection of, you know, shenanigans, but then the money, and then so Britain really working with Saudi Arabia. Here's a line where it says the Kuwaitis' investment in Britain meant that they would, in the approving words of one foreign office, avoid the necessity of sharing their oil wealth with their neighbors, a view demonstrating that British officials were perfectly aware that their priorities conflicted with the needs of poor Middle Easterners. And then later on down the page, I'll just read this long paragraph because I have a note that it's a turning point. At first, the British had some success in cracking down on nationalist forces in the region, but as the decade wore on, British weakness became more apparent. In November 1967, it was forced into a humiliating withdrawal from its colony of Aden, pushed out by the forces of the National Liberation Front, which had been fighting for independence with Egyptian support since 63. Increasing British reliance on the Saudis to maintain the pro-Western status quo and to deter Nasserite infiltration of Arabia and the wider Middle East coincided with a development inside the kingdom which that would have huge consequences for the eventual advance of global terrorism. At the beginning of the 1960s, the Saudis embarked on a global Islamic mission to Wahhabize Islam, spread Saudi influence, and counter Nasser, a process that marks the beginning of the resurgence of radical right political Islam. So that's, you know, 1960s there, early 60s, talking about the Saudis beginning to really, you know, and later on the book shows that this is done through building mosques, through school system, you know, schools. And so you get this picture of this, I don't know what you call it. It's sort of an empire franchising of religion and education, and then it's backed by various, you know, factions, some more radical than others, which has led to this uprising, upswelling of what we call this radical, you know, radical Islam, what he calls, I would call it a sort of extremist or fundamentalist, and it's, you know, backed by the this corporate government fascist stuff. Yeah, here it shows how the following an international Islamic conference in Mecca, convened by Crown Prince Faisal in 1962, the Saudis established the Muslim World League, which, managed by the Saudi religious establishment, sent out missionaries, printed propaganda, and financed the building of mosques and Islamic associations around the globe. Well, that's, I don't know all the details, but it reminds of the Christian, you know, the Christian missionaries and that whole thing, the danger of these, you know, religiots proselytizing, and this is, you know, proselytizing with the backing of the corporate state is just seems, it's doesn't seem, it's extremely dangerous. And here's a talk about one of these Islamic societies. The League's first proclamation read, "Those who distort Islam's call under the guise of nationalism are the most bitter enemies of the Arabs, whose glories are intertwined, or glories are entwined with the glories of Islam." So you get this whole conflict of religion and national identity. Those who distort Islam's call under the guise of nationalism are the most bitter enemies of the Arabs. Faisal, who took over as Saudi king in 64, fancied himself as the king of Islam, and on his formal assumption to power, he addressed the nation with the words, "The first thing we wish from you is devotion to God, to cling to the teachings of his religion and rules of his Sharia, holy law, since this is the basis of our glory, the underlying factor of our rules and the secret of our power." The goal in foreign policy, Faisal said, would be, quote, "to move along with the Islamic nations in everything which may achieve for Muslims their glory and the raising of their standards." So a lot of the now I'm seeing a lot of the blowback. I mean, there's still an effect of the blowback, but it seems more like from its origins it was not so much the blowback as an opportunity. You know, these inter whatever squabbles, and then opportunities to spread the messages and words, so to speak. I'm just going to read some quotes. It's so in-depth. This is barely get through this chapter at this pace. I'll try to read some quotes. "The important role played both by the British and the Wahhabi clerics in sanctioning a palace coup highlighted the two forces, in addition to the Americans, on which the Saudi rulers were dependent. The Muslim Brotherhood becoming an organizational nerve center and meeting place for Islamists across the world. During the 60s, thousands of Muslim brothers moved to Europe, notably Germany, gradually establishing a wide and well-organized network of mosques, charities, and Islamic organizations, hoping to win more Muslim hearts and minds." So there's a tricky thing where you have charities, so there's good stuff mixed in there. Blah, blah, blah. They included a Palestinian refugee named Abdullah Azam, who, as a lecturer at Jeddah University, would mentor the young Osama bin Laden and in the early 1980s be at the forefront of the jihad against the Soviets in Afghanistan. Another lecturer at Jeddah was the Egyptian Muhammad Qutb, brother of the leading Islamist ideologue Saeed, who was languishing in one of Nasser's jails. This fusion of local clerics trained in the Saudi Wahhabite tradition with the international activism of the exiled Muslim brothers helped provide the intellectual and ideological basis for the later development of Al-Qaeda. And then, skipping a little bit ahead of your forced underground, the Egyptian Brotherhood only reemerged after Nasser's death in 1970. And mid-60s, meanwhile, Britain and the U.S. continued to build up the Saudis as a counter to Arab nationalism. British officials continued to express their preference for a Saudi regime based on Islamic fundamentalism to the prospect of an Arab nationalist one. Since a change of regime which lined up the country with its large oil revenues with the Republican Arab states would upset the whole balance of power in the Middle East. It was in Yemen where British and Saudi foreign policy interests most coincided in their bolstering of religious conservative forces against the Arab nationalist threat. And I don't know what happened to Yemen, because there's here they mention the North Yemen, so I don't know if that got resolved. But the war ended only when the Saudis, the chief financiers of the rebels, cut off their aid in 1969 and a treaty was signed creating North Yemen. And let's see, the nature of the Saudi regime was well understood by the British. In June 1963, the British ambassador Sir Colin Crowe summed the country up in no uncertain terms. Saudi Arabia was, he said, dominated by a sect of Islam of a farouche, I don't know what that word is, of a farouche and intolerant Puritanism, but ruled by a royal family whose extravagance and dissipation are only rivaled by its numbers. It has no modern code of laws, and its criminal justice is of medieval barbarity. There is not even a pretense of democratic institutions, and though slavery has been abolished, slaves are still to be found. Corruption is widespread. The country sits on top of some of the richest oil reserves and oil resources in the world, and enjoys a vast, unearned income, which has dissipated in pleasure, palaces, and Cadillacs. And we fast forward to recent news of Saudi, maybe, you know, some of the next generation and the power starting to slip a little bit. The British political elite was united in its backing of the Saudi ruling family, seeing it as a force for regional, quote, stability, and, quote, the supply of oil and an increasing important buyer of British arms. The British-Saudi Entente Cordiale was marked by a major new arms contract worth over £100 million, involving a dozen fighter aircraft together with ground control and communications equipment, training and maintenance. And then the second half of this chapter, the Indonesian slaughter while Saudi Arabia was building up. And then here's in 1965, we got a British official writing, blah, 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 in McCarthy's list of these notables. One name in particular catches the eye. Bin Laden, a reference to Mohammed, Osama's father, whose construction company had several multi-million contracts with the House of Saud. I'm also learning from this book how hard it is. I mean, unless you're like full tilt historian, even then it's probably challenging to, because there's so many fragments and factions and reasons and it's hard to sort of carry all the, to remember all the reasons and who's doing what and whose side who's on, because it's so splintered. While Saudi Arabia was building up its Islamic foreign policy, in Indonesia, Islamist mobs were helping the army conduct one of the worst slaughters of the 20th century with British and U.S. covert backing. The Indonesian military had long wanted to move against the Communist Party, the PKI, which, with 2 million members, was the largest communist force outside the Soviet Union in China and exerted increasing but limited influence over the regime of National President Ahmed Sukarno. Suharto is, I think, the next guy. Suharto gradually outmaneuvered President Sukarno and emerged as the new Indonesian ruler. He established a repressive dictatorship that would last until 1998. A little bit further on, the events set back the emergence of democracy in Indonesia for more than a generation. And here's a highlighted quote, the bit, the rights of Middle Easterners were sacrificed on the altar of pure geostrategic concerns and deeply conservative ones at that, from which the region is still to recover. That's prefaced by, yet the interests of the people in the region were irrelevant to British planners. There is barely a reference to them in the hundreds of documents surveyed for this research. Chilling. At first it appeared as if the principal beneficiaries of the decline of Arab nationalism would be London, and Washington's preferred alternative, the Islamic monarchies in Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and the Gulf, to which they had extended considerable backing. But it was the more radical Islamist alternative that benefited the most. British officials noted that the 1967 Arab defeat was followed by a noticeable religious revival and a remarkable increase in religious feeling in Egypt, including widespread demands for the implementation of Sharia law. Islamist forces would now pose as the solution to the Middle East problems among its poor masses, aided by the massive gap in living standards between them and the secular elites. So that's one of the appeals of this radical fundamentalist Islamic stuff, is the the poor masses and the living standards, whether those elites are Arab or not. And wrapping up this chapter, in Egypt, within 3 years of the 67 war, a weakened Nasser was dead. His successor Anwar Sadat turned away from the nationalist model and sought to Islamize Egyptian society, partly by cultivating the Muslim Brotherhood, which Nasser had repressed for so many years. By now, many Islamist groups in the Middle East had become still further radicalized, partly due to having been savagely repressed by many of the secular regimes. The stage was set for the Islamist revival that was to sweep the region throughout the 70s. So that's it for this this little chapter report. It's a lot of information, though. You can see the recurring themes, the recurring trends, how it connects, how it sort of laid some of the groundwork for what's going on nowadays. And in general, just an amazing education on how stuff, it's hard not to say shit when I'm doing these shows, because it's how the shit works, because it's somewhat astounding to see the level of manipulation, especially with that, just the inhumanity of the British, that report of saying that, they weren't even mentioned about the people. And again, even up to page 200, where it's mentioning, again and again, oil and gas resources as these prime driving forces, and then mixed in with all the other stuff. So, all right, thanks for listening. Have a good one.